This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with your hosts, Zara Tangora and Bobby Comforto. You'll have to excuse me for some unexplainable reason. I decided to eat some peanuts before recording this intro. So I'm just still trying to work that out mouth-wise. Guys, hi, how are ya? Another week of strangeness. I am slightly soothed by the nice weather. Bobby and I were able to have a little distanced Mother's Day. We got to go sit in her yard together, spaced apart, and that was really nice. And you know, Mother's Day, even when you have a wonderful mom, can still be a weird day. It's, you know, it's a lot of holidays can bring up a lot of feelings for folks. So we hope that you guys got through that and that you enjoyed our episode with Jenny Indig. It was a very touching and very sweet episode. And today on the show, we have a great guest, a really fun, amazing woman, Jessie Sheehan. Jessie is the author of The Vintage Baker. She is an incredible baker. She is, on Instagram is Jessie Sheehan Bakes. If you don't follow her already, just the amazing confections that this woman is creating on a daily basis is it's really just joyful. The things she makes are just fun and playful and delicious. I recently called upon her for a recipe because I had some extra sour cream, and she gave me a great recipe for a sour cream chocolate cake. And Jessie comes on today to talk to us about her battle with breast cancer and how baking and cooking played into it. I mean, mostly baking, because she really is an amazing baker. And her story is really interesting and uplifting. And Jessie is just such a shining light of a person. She's one of those people that walks into a room and makes it brighter. So it was wonderful to talk to her. And we hope that you enjoy our conversation with Jessie. And we hope that you guys are all hanging in there and taking care of yourselves and each other. Okay, bye.
Hi, Jessie Sheehan, or Sheehan, but we've discussed you can say it either way.
Yes, you can. Hi.
So it's really Sheehan.
Yes.
But Sheehan is maybe helpful for folks just trying to look you up. Or
100%.
There's so many different ways.
Hello.
Tomato, tomato. Am I right?
100%.
Ladies.
Hi, Jessie.
Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Jessie. So Jessie is a cookbook author, recipe developer, and food writer. And the author of The Vintage Baker.
Indeed.
Which is a wonderful book that you've brought us a copy of, which I cannot wait to tuck into.
Yes, yay.
I follow you on Instagram. Mm. And I'm always looking at your delicious cakes, but particularly you make these snacking cakes.
Yes, I am obsessed with snacking cakes.
Okay. Now, Is a snacking cake exactly what it sounds like? A cake that you could take like a little sliver off of throughout the day?
100%. I mean, everybody has like a slightly different idea about what a snacking cake is. But to me, a snacking cake is different than like a sheet cake mm-hmm. because it's in like an 8x8 or a 9x9 pan rather than I think of a sheet cake as being a 13x9x2 pan.
Right.
But essentially, it's a one-layer cake. In my world, with an insane amount of frosting on top, like frosting to cake ratio is really excellent.
Yeah.
But you could be more, maybe you're not as frosting forward as I am.
We are.
Oh, yeah, we're frosting forward. We're pro-frosting 100% on this podcast, yeah.
Because you could just sprinkle a little confectioner sugar on it, a little whipped cream, but
Get out of here.
I'm into frosting.
Of course. Where did this love of sweets begin for you?
So it's... The voracious sweet tooth has always been there, like since I was little, no question. But I didn't like, you know, my mother stocked our kitchen with like devil dogs and double stuffed Oreos and Pepperidge Farm raspberry turnovers. Like these are like my fave things from being little. But no one was a baker in my house, neither of my parents. I had a grandmother in Cleveland. I grew up in Boston who was into baking. But I wasn't even into like getting in the kitchen with her. I just liked visiting because you got to eat all the stuff.
Yeah.
So it was this funny path where I was always sourcing out the best yummy things to eat and buy, but never wanting to make them myself until my career kind of has had many different kind of facets. And I was an actress when I graduated from college.
Oh my
gosh.
And
then I was a lawyer.
Wait a minute. Hang on. Excuse us.
Cut.
Pause. what kind of actress?
So I went to college in New York City. And I when I graduated, I started doing sort of like off Broadway theater, voiceover work. Then I started doing regional theater, so I would leave New York to do plays. And just as things always seem to work in life, just as things were getting good and like my agents were getting me work, I was done. Because it's tough, and I think, I mean, that sounds so silly. Of course it's tough. A lot of things are tough. But what was particularly hard about it is, there's no meritocracy, really. You know, it doesn't matter if you really work really hard.
Yeah.
And are even talented.
Right.
Which I think I was. I probably wasn't the best, but I was pretty good. But that doesn't, it sort of doesn't matter in that world. And that's probably true in a lot of different kinds of creative jobs. But I think I was drawn to go to law school because I was sick of getting on airplanes and having people ask me what I did for a living. And I would say actress. And they would say, oh, what restaurant? Like, then they would start guffawing.
Right. So it was important to you to kind of transition to something that felt more meaningful and that you could take a little bit more, like, ownership in.
Yeah. Okay. It's funny that I've now come full circle and I'm back being a kind of freelance creative person. Mm-hmm. But I really craved, like, I wanted to go to a job every day.
Yeah.
Or I thought I did because I really, I went to law school, which I loved because I'm weird and I like school.
Yeah.
But then I graduated and I clerked for a year and practiced for two and I was done. So I wouldn't say I had an illustrious legal career.
Right.
I had brief one.
Yeah. Interesting, though. It's like I'm thinking about some of the parallels between baking and law, and it's all kind of coming together. I'm painting a picture of you.
100%.
And I'm getting to understand a little bit, a little bit about how your brain might work. So growing up, you grew up in Massachusetts.
Yes.
What was your family structure all about? You said that cooking wasn't a huge thing.
Cooking wasn't a big thing. Well, baking definitely wasn't a big thing. Cooking wasn't a big thing. Both my parents worked. My mother actually had someone who came once a week and like cooked out of the Silver Palette cookbook for us and put everything in like sealed bags. Mm-hmm. You know those machines where you can like sealed that all up, put it in the refrigerator, and we ate that all week long. Now you would think that I would have been in heaven because that's an excellent, excellent cookbook.
Absolutely.
I don't know what my problem was.
Yeah.
I think my brother's problem was that it wasn't my mom cooking, and maybe he was already like a little tiny sexist person, and he was like, "Why doesn't mom cook for me?" Me? I don't know if I was a tiny sexist person or not, but I just didn't love the food
or anti-plastic bags.
There you go. Maybe that was it. Maybe it was before my time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, because it's, even though it's delicious food and it's, you know, made from a great cookbook, there is still something about not having it be, not seeing the process, right?
Of course.
100%.
And knowing that your background now is like in acting, which is process, and practicing law and baking, like there is something that maybe was attractive about process and seeing it happen. And even though your family wasn't making food, and that didn't seem to be something that was an important part of the upbringing. It's obviously somewhere to you important. Yes. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But but funnily enough, we all loved food. Like, we searched out good restaurants, and, you know, that was important to everyone in my family and still is. But it wasn't that story. I know a little bit about your life with growing up with Bobby and your dad. That's not my story.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my gosh, we're doing this, or it's Sunday and we make this on Sundays. And it didn't really work like
that. What kind of flavor profile do you think that you learned to like when you were young?
That's a good question. I mean, I think I learned to like everything. Do you know what I mean? Like very broad, you know, we were going to have Chinese food or Indian food or Italian food. Like, we were always eating kind of everything. I would say like an appreciation for like well-flavored, in the sense of like, I'm kind of really into salt.
Samesies.
My whole family were like, you know, like we were always like this, I think I need a little salt. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, not that salt is a flavor, but the idea of enhancing.
It brings out.
Yeah.
The idea of enhancing whatever you've been given with, like, I think this needs salt.
Right.
But it's funny. I think there was something there in terms of an appreciation because of food and sweets and all of that, because eventually, after being a lawyer and after being an actress, and I was a stay-at-home mom for a little while, I kind of felt like I loved being with my boys. I love my kids. I love that people stay home with their kids, men and women. But for me, it was sort of, I needed to be doing something outside of my house. And it was like a friend of mine who said to me, like, well, you love sweets. Like, go learn something about making them.
Right.
So I went to Baked, which is a bakery in Red Hook, that kind of made, and still does, make these kind of like old school Americana sweets, which I kind of knew-ish was my thing. I don't think I could have articulated it that way, but I knew that the kind of sweets I loved kind of were like my Devil Dogs and my Devil Stuffed Oreos and my raspberry turnovers from Pepperidge Farm. You know, kind of like big. Big is always the operative word with me. I'm not like a petite snack person. Big. Like big and lots of cream and lots of cake and something flaky and yummy and buttery like that turnover and Oreo cookies that had like maybe a little too much filling.
Right.
And I went into Baked and essentially said like, hey, want to teach me everything you know? I'm dying to learn. And they, of course, thought I was insane because what like – older mom, because I was an older mom, like walks in and says that.
Right.
I think they really thought I was crazy.
It was your neighborhood, right?
Yes.
And your neighborhood is in Red Hook.
Yes.
Right. Well, I just want to go back for a second, though. What do you think it is from, can you pinpoint anything? Now, you said your family, you all had kind of like had a salty palate and you learned to like lots of different kinds of food.
Yeah.
Can you pinpoint what you think it is that makes you like extra frosting and bold things? Because I think it's interesting because actually Bobby and I are very similar.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like an interesting thing to think about. What separates the people from like a, you know, a little swipe of mayo, condiment people from not condiment people.
I love mayonnaise.
Right.
Do you guys love mayonnaise?
Oh my God.
Mayonnaise is my life.
Yes, of course. So I want to know if there was anything like from that you can pinpoint from growing up, or where did you learn to like this? I learned it from Bobby and my dad. So where did you learn this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure if I could pinpoint it on a parent per se or a grandparent. Although, again, I think my family likes the same kinds of things I like. They're probably a little more flexible than I am, where I'm really not going to probably order the petite, gorgeous French tart
that
kind of doesn't have anything going on that's like creamy and yummy and over the top. I'm probably going to pass on that and get the pudding.
Yeah.
But I will say that just my personality, I'm like big and into a lot. And like when I do it fully. And so it's like it's almost like the desserts kind of speak to the kind of way I live my life in a way. I mean, I don't want to be like, oh, I live life to its fullest.
No, but I think it is. What I was circling around was that I think that is indicative of a lust for life.
Yes.
Zest.
Right? Yes. So I find that people who like extra or more or like get, you know what I mean? And it can represent itself 100%. Through food really tend to be people who have a lust for life.
Right. And I'm just going to say like that, like when I like to drink wine, I probably like to drink too much
Same.
Wine. You know, so everything – Look, I also have a lot of discipline, and I'm a disciplined person.
Absolutely.
But I also, when I'm allowing myself to, like, go at it, I will.
Live it to the fullest.
I really do.
As the kiddos would say, you're extra. Yeah. But same, we're extra, too. What were you going
to
say, Bobby?
I was about to say, you always describe it to me that I eat the guts in the lobster.
Oh, yeah, you suck those guts out.
Yes, 100%.
For real, you know, and, like, eating with your hands and, like, so... I want to ask you then, with this knowledge that you have a lust for life. So it leads you to leave your career as an entertainment lawyer, which I think is also interesting because this is like a solid career. I'm sure you made good money and you had stability, but yet you were like inspired to chase a dream, which is, you know, to go back and learn, as you were just mentioning before, about going to Baked and working with young kiddos and like starting from the beginning. So I think, again, we're seeing your lust for life and your passion and just kind of like impulsivity, perhaps, and chasing, you know, the goodness and the richness and the extra.
Yes, 100%. The extra.
So, okay, so you're then at Baked. You decide, why did you decide to leave your career exactly? What was that moment where you're like, I'm done with this. I need to be a baker.
Well, funnily enough, and I joke that I'm still on maternity leave, it coincided with the birth of my 16-year-old. So it was a long time ago.
Okay.
But essentially, I went on maternity leave when he was born, and I was like, I'll see you in 3 months. And that was 16 years ago.
Amazing.
But I think... I knew right away it wasn't for me. Again, I loved the law school part. I like to, not like a wildly competitive person, but I do like to like succeed and do really well. So I'm like, I like being a student. I like getting grades. Do you know, I'm that kind of like annoying person. And so I liked all of that part. And I liked clerking for a judge because that's mostly writing.
Yeah.
But then when I got to being a lawyer and you had to like fight with people, I hate fighting. Right. I want everyone to get along. Every case I got, I wanted to settle. My partners were like, you know what? We are not settling. We are fighting.
That's amazing.
So it was just knowing I was in the wrong place. And then funnily enough, like, also realizing like this is not the environment for me. I don't want to be in an office every day. Right. I hated the lack of control you have because, you know, you could be sitting at your desk at 7:30, closing up your computer, ready to go home, and you get a call from a partner saying, hey, you're staying tonight. Order dinner because we're going to get working on a brief. So that was also I do have a zest and lust for life, but I'm also a control freak, and I like to have my zest and my lust on my own terms.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of control freaks in the kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's interesting. I was working on a project this week and noticed that I often work on my own, and so I'm unaware sometimes of my own controlling tendencies at this point. But then when you see it with other, you know, other folks, and not that it was anything bad, but it is interesting about chefs and control.
I feel that way now because I obviously work alone. I'm never around other people. And, I don't know. I miss it, but I also know that I'm so specific in the way I like things done. It's hard to imagine, like, you know, it's hard to imagine being in a work environment where you're interfacing with people all the time.
It really is once you go back from it. So while you're at Baked, you are diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yes.
And you were 41?
Yes.
Okay. What was that like for you?
So that was so I had two little kids, which I think was is an important kind of piece of the puzzle because it wasn't like the kind of thing that I imagine feels differently if it's just you.
Yeah.
Maybe you and your husband or partner or girlfriend or boyfriend, but basically just you. So everything about it, I would say, was experienced in with the lens of them.
Yes.
And because they were so tiny, for better or for worse, the kind of breast cancer I was diagnosed with was bad enough that I ended up getting a double mastectomy and having chemo and radiation, but quote unquote good. I mean, it sounds funny, but I'm just going to say it. But good enough that that it was slow growing. I mean, these are kind of like nitty gritty details. We can delete these, but it was slow growing cancer. There were some good pieces of it, and the message I got from all the doctors, et cetera, that were advising me was, you know, this is good cancer, slow growing cancer, this, that, and the other. Right. But you have tiny kids. I was bringing it full circle to the kids. You have tiny kids, so if I were you, I would attack this with the most aggressive treatment. So I met doctors who said, you don't need chemo. Mm-hmm. You really don't. Or you don't, but blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Long story short, I took very aggressive measures because of the kids. not to say that I wouldn't have anyway, because I was 41 and that's, you know, relative. Yeah. Now that seems very young, but that's relatively young. Yeah. And so the kids did color sort of my experience with that. It also made it so that, you know, I didn't like lie around the house like, again, it's not really, we're back to the zest and the lust. It's not really my personality, but maybe I would have been a little bit more indulgent about relaxing, taking it easy during the treatment, mm-hmm. after of the course. Operation, et cetera. And I wasn't, because when they were that little, it was interesting. The doctors told you, or the therapist in the hospital said, the best way to deal with it with your kids is to tell them, particularly the chemo, because you don't have any hair,
yeah.
Is to tell your kids that you're taking very strong medicine because you got sick. And that's just mm-hmm. how I described it. Yeah. I'm not even sure I ever said the word cancer to them, but right. they were only 6 and 4. So they right. were tiny.
It was the facts.
It was the facts, and it was just a way for them to understand the way I looked. But when I had my actual surgery, I don't know, again, not saying that this is how everybody behaves or reacts, but I was up and about pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I never even kind of said to my kids, mommy's going to the hospital, then mommy's coming back, then mommy's lying in bed. It was, they were little enough, which I'm grateful for, that yeah. we could kind of almost.
Right. You could avoid the maybe really deep conversation because they couldn't even probably retain it.
And try to not make it traumatic.
Totally. Yeah. And I would say in a funny way, and I'm just thinking about this now out loud, but having to deal with them probably made things easier mm-hmm. because you right. couldn't kind of collapse into yourself or your own sadness or your own, because you were focused on, you know, putting on a relatively, I mean, I'm not saying I was like walking around like with like a huge smile on my face 100% of the time, but a lot of the time.
Well, I think it's interesting, actually, the thing we've talked to various different people yeah. in here and then just in life, right?
Yeah.
And people have all these different attitudes towards dealing with trauma and yeah. crisis, right? Whether it be cancer or the death of a loved one.
Yep.
And I feel like the need to go on for someone else is generally what I've found people say propels them through this time without.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Do you agree, Mom, in your practice?
I do.
Do you?
I think there's two things I'm thinking of. It's what happens to us in life and the way we view it. So mm-hmm. everybody really does have a different lens. They can feel like a victim. They can feel angry. I think in your case, your primary lens was your kids. You were mm-hmm. viewing it through their well-being mm-hmm. and their future and the hope. Mm-hmm. That you needed to have
100%
to be with them.
I'm wondering, and this could be totally not connected, mm-hmm. but so you have young kids, you're diagnosed with breast cancer, mm-hmm. you're finding a need to get, you know, through this.
Mm-hmm.
Is the baking of these, you know, and particularly baking of these vintage, really mm-hmm. nostalgic sweets, do you feel like there's any correlation there of wanting to kind of go back to almost like a nostalgic childhood thing, make things for your kids mm-hmm. while you're going through something that's so intense? Is there any correlation for you there?
It's funny. I think that there was always, like I said earlier, even though I would never have put the word vintage on it, and I might not even have said nostalgic, I think there was always a sense, like when I first walked into Baked, before I ever applied for a job there, the idea of like, oh my gosh, yes, these huge layer cakes and these big cookies and these like this coffee cake that like is enormous, like that is, those are my desserts, those are my, that's me. So I think it was I think that part of me was always there. What I do think about those desserts in a different way but kind of the same is, because I was working there when I was diagnosed, I certainly feel like the experience of being there and of working during my treatment was, I don't know, huge I won't say recovery exactly, but for the speed with which, or the it just made getting through everything a little easier.
Well, in reading your article, you know, when I got cancer, baking made me feel powerful.
Yeah.
When you said flour, butter, and sugar, that you were among flour, butter, and sugar, I could sense it. My thought of what butter,
yeah,
you know, flour and sugar feel like, smell like,
100%.
It was such a warm feeling
right.
when I thought that.
100%. And yeah. it was this funny combo of being in that bakery, of being able to make these yummy, sweet, delicious things that were great in and of themselves, also distracting from like everything else that was going on. And then this third kind of funny component that was unexpected, which is that everybody I was working with was at least a decade younger than me, including the people who owned the bakery. I mean, they weren't a decade younger than me, but they were younger than me. And really kind of digging being with these people who were so different than everyone else in my life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also producing, right? So you're a cog in a small machine, but, you know, you're working actively to produce something. You're working for your kids. I feel like this is all also kind of feeling connected for me in terms of you being able to kind of get through this, you know, diagnosis and treatment with, you know, strength and poise. And I'm sure at times it was very hard, but the way you're describing it, it seemed like, you know, you almost like you were focused, right? Yeah. You're focused on your kids, you're focused on your work. And reading your article, the same article Bobby just talked about, you were talking about filling whoopie pies.
Yeah.
Sometimes, right? Sometimes the decorators would fill them, but sometimes you would make the cake part.
Yeah.
Simple and just process.
And thinking about that, I started researching about baking and mindfulness. And really, it's absolutely. Like, and we talk a lot about this, and I'm just interested. You know, we always talk about, like, you know, you take your brain offline. It's like meditative. But what it really is actually, it kind of is the practice of mindfulness. And Bobby, can you talk about mindfulness a little bit? Because you know way more about it than
absolutely.
I do.
Absolutely. I think in any type of emergency that we have, the best thing we can do is ground ourselves. And grounding often means simple, repetitive things, but it also means trying to be in the moment so that you're not in your head, and where your head is panicking and worrying and thinking ahead and thinking back. And it's really learning to be in the moment and notice the difference between when you are in the past and when you are in the future, and just bringing yourself to the moment and those simple, repetitive things. I mean, this wonderful Thich Nhat Hanh talks about carrying water. You know, just carrying it up a mountain, one bucket at a time.
Mm.
You know, people talk about gardening. We had a wonderful guest a couple months ago, Donna, who talked about, you know, digging in the earth. And that is a mindful moment. There's nothing else but the earth and you, or the flour, butter, and sugar and you, or the things you have to cut out at certain shapes over and over. And it's just keeping your mind focused. So mindfulness is so important, and I use it all the time with all the people that have trauma that I see.
Yeah.
You know, I find out from them what are their simple tasks, because I can't tell them to bake because they may not like that. You know, for somebody it's vacuuming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, for somebody it's sorting through things. Mm-hmm. And somebody was telling me the other day how they was keep sorting through drawers and looking at all the little things, but you're in that moment. You're just in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
really interesting.
Yeah.
Had you had any previous experiences with trauma or loss that, like, facilitated you in this process?
That's a good question. I'm going to say no. I mean, I'd lost my grandparents, who I was close to, and my mother's best friend had died of cancer when I was in, or right out of college, and I was very close to her. She had that awful multiple myeloma, you know.
My dad died of that.
That's what I thought.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an awful one.
Yeah.
Although I guess the treatment is getting, well, anyway, that's a different podcast.
The treatment is getting, no, you're right. The treatment's getting a lot better for stem cell research and stuff. But it used to be a lot more of an instant thing.
Yeah. That was a little bit more like for her. But I would say in general, no. Here's something. When I was a senior in high school, or just graduated, my brother had a very, very bad accident and was in a coma for a couple of weeks. And that was definitely an experience, I think, that taught me strength under pressure, strength during sadness. It got me very comfortable, I have to say, with hospitals and that whole world. I'm like the queen of the hospital. Like, I can do a hospital like nobody's business.
Right. Well, that's actually a really interesting point, and it's very true, and something people don't think about a lot, because when you first have to kind of go into a hospital and be with someone for a long time, it is a very jarring experience, and it's very weird.
Yeah.
And it is something we don't think about. We don't think about it until we have to do it.
Yeah.
And it can be so shocking and upsetting. You're like, oh, what do I touch? Where am I? And the smells, I don't want to like open my nose. I don't 100%. Open my eyes. Like, why am I in here? And then once you do it, it, you know, not that it gets better, but it does become like something you're more.
For some people, it's a trauma, the hospital itself.
Yeah.
It's so traumatic, they can't pass by a hospital.
I feel of both mindsets. Yeah. I'm very comfortable in a hospital, so it doesn't scare me, but I do hate it.
Yeah.
You know? But that's an interesting thing. Yeah. So you got comfortable with that.
Yeah. I feel like it's I'm really into giving back now. Like when anybody who has breast cancer, friend of a friend, like call me, I'll talk to you. I mean, obviously it's so, medicine in a great way changes so much so quickly that even now my experience is going to be different than somebody else's because everything is different. Like when I was diagnosed, I would talk to women who had breast cancer, including Dana Callan.
Yeah.
We were connected by a mutual friend back then. But anyway, and they would tell me about their experience and tell me how awful chemo was and how sick they were and this and that. And you know what? By the time I was having chemo, it was a little bit better. I mean, I'm not saying chemo fucking sucks.
Right.
Excuse my French.
Oh, no.
But I wasn't horribly sick. They were giving people steroids and different other drugs to help you deal with that. But what I was going to say is I like to give back. And I do so when I hear somebody needs to be in the hospital. And if I'm not like searching them out, like Googling, who needs to go to the hospital? Let me call them. But the point is I can give them advice. Like, look, if you can afford it, you need a private room for this kind of surgery you're having because it's going to suck.
Yeah.
And if you can't, don't worry. But what about a nurse? Or make sure someone sleeps in the room with you. It sucks to wake up in the middle of the night and have to pee.
Right.
And you are not... can't make it to the bathroom. But, you know, stuff like that, that I feel like is good advice that you only know...
It's great.
If you've been there.
Can I go back and ask you one question? Yeah. When your brother had that accident, so you were in high school.
Yeah.
How do you remember your family coping? And what about food?
Right.
Came to that.
Good question. Food-wise, we all loved like dim sum. We had grown up going to dim sum. So my mother would bring my brother Peking dumplings all the time from our local Chinese restaurant. I remember she tells a story of like one time going, and my brother was obviously awake from his coma because otherwise... he wouldn't be able to eat, but maybe she didn't have enough money or something, and she cried, and the restaurateur gave her the food, you know.
Oh, gave it to her for free?
Yes.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
I remember the dumplings, and I remember it was a hospital in Boston where I grew up, and right nearby, I can't remember the name, but it was an iconic, like, Philly cheesesteak kind of place. Maybe not Philly, but a cheesesteak kind of place, and I remember going with my brother there. Maybe when he was in a wheelchair, but anyway, bringing him there to eat the steak, the things that we loved. Again, it's not homemade stuff. Nobody was like bringing in cookies for
but
my brother.
But people remember that, even if it's the stale sandwich in the cafeteria. But you remember sitting with whoever you're sitting with, and you're feeling so intense at the time.
Yeah.
And the food has a special importance,
100%.
Unusual importance.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah. So I
not necessarily good, but unusual.
Yeah, those were two good food memories of that time with my brother.
Totally. Well, it's interesting because I think, and you kind of mentioned this in that article that we were referencing earlier. The moms, when you're dropping your son off at preschool, the moms kind of looking at you in a way that was like a little bit triggering and sometimes really upsetting, kind of like pity almost. And
the tilted heads.
The tilted heads. And it's kind of like, and then I'm trying to put myself there. I'm putting myself in your position and their position. And the kind of, it could never happen to me. Oh, it's always somebody else mentality, right? Like, oh, they got cancer, how upsetting. Or, you know, but in your case, your brother had been in a situation where it's one of those, oh, that happens to somebody else, right? A terrible car accident, you go into a coma. So did that in some way prepare you, knowing that life actually happens?
Interesting.
That trauma happens,
and
that
survival.
Life is like, and survival happens. How did that facilitate you and your diagnosis at all?
That's so interesting.
It's part of your trauma history. I didn't mean to
interrupt
that.
No,
so
that's okay.
It helps to understand that in way of resilience.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point because I think there were two parts of that. I think on the one hand, it was my brother. It wasn't me.
Mm.
And I really think the thing about getting cancer or something like that happening to you, your body, is that you can't believe it happened to you because you thought that was always going to be someone else. With my brother, it happened to our family. But I have to say, knock on wood, it didn't make me a very an anxious mom. I'll just tell you quickly what the accident was. He was on a rope swing in a canoe with my parent. My parents saw it happen. But anyway, he was on the rope swing. He let go a little too soon, and the water was shallow, and there were rocks. He's great today, FYI.
All right. Thank goodness.
Hi, Jonah. Not that he's going to listen. but anyway, It was like I was used to trauma happening to my family because it had happened to my brother. I don't think But I, this is what I started to say. I know now, like as a mom, I'm not a super anxious mom. I'm not the mom who says, you can't go on the rope swing. I'm just not.
Right.
I'm not the mom who says, like, oh my God, you don't have your seatbelt on. Like, I want them to wear a seatbelt, but I'm not like losing my shit. If you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Somehow the trauma got worked through. Yeah. It's traumas that don't really fully get worked through that end up being kind of a PTSD thing.
Interesting.
So you don't have that.
Yeah, I really don't. Yeah. It probably helps that I wasn't there.
Totally.
You know, yeah. So I didn't actually see it. But I would say when I was diagnosed with cancer, there was definitely that like, really? Like that happened to me?
Yeah.
And that, and what you were describing before about like my experience at, in my kid's school was, I think I perhaps care a little too much what other people think of me and how people behave around me. And so I hated being the one that everybody was kind of giving like the side, like sideways eye to, or being extra, Jessie, you know, I hated the, like the kind of pity-ishness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's always been me. Like I remember that with like girls in high school, they were my friends and they were graduating and I wasn't, and they were like, poor Jen. And I, for some reason, I don't exactly know why. Maybe Bobby can tell me.
Yes, exactly, Bobby, please.
But
why is she like this?
I had this thing about like not wanting to be kind of pointed out or in that way. And so I just hated watching these moms behave that way around me. I had a wig, and I, of course, at first thought, oh, my wig's amazing. Like, no one can tell. I look 100% fab. And, like, obviously, people could tell. Maybe not everyone, but most people could tell. So, like, that was hard and weird for me, too. I mean, I was so kind of funny about not wanting to be kind of victimized by people or pitied. I never took my wig off except in front of my husband and my two children. Wow. I didn't even let my mother see me without a wig. Yeah. I did not want anyone seeing me that way.
Yeah.
And just to connect it to my experience at the bakery, what I found at work was that I think because the women were so much younger, like breast cancer, it wasn't going to happen to them.
Right.
So they didn't, they just were so cool with me.
Right.
And relaxed and curious and just like, really? Like,
it did bring up fear in them.
No.
Yeah. Right.
And so they were amazing to hang out with because they just wanted to like, what happened today? Ooh, yuck, really? Okay.
How was your husband during that time? Personal question.
Yeah, no, that's all right. This is a personal podcast. he was great. He was not like going to come with me to every one of my chemo sessions. He was not the husband who was like trying to call my doctors and like find out what. I was definitely the lead on cancer. Mm-hmm. He was kind of took the back seat. Whereas I think some partners might be a little bit more like, oh my God, this is happening. How can I control this? I'm going to get involved. I'm going to find it. I'm going to talk to her doctors. I'm going to be there every time she has chemo.
Sure.
That is not Matt. Mm-hmm. He came the first time and he came the last time. And then I had 16 weeks, so 8 different treatments. And in the middle 6, I filled with friends.
Okay.
So every time. But I wouldn't even let my mom come.
Mm.
Because, again, it was so painful for her, obviously, daughter, that I couldn't handle it.
Hmm. So you didn't want to surround yourself with anybody that looked afraid, that was afraid, that expressed pity, that
100%.
You know, was depressed about it, that 100%. Was upset about it.
I mean, now that I say that out loud in the conversation with my husband, it makes sense to me in a way that his attitude didn't bother me. It was, you know, he kind of acted like I was, you know, okay,
right.
You okay?
Interesting, because this is similar, I feel like, to Dana's how Dana spoke about her experience with cancer.
Did you hear that?
I did, 100%.
And, you know, I think there's just different types of people.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Kind of how you were talking about earlier about how the experience with your brother being an accident didn't make you a helicopter parent.
No.
In the same way, you know, it's like seeing that things can happen, right? And you can kind of go one of two ways. And of course, there's a middle there. But it's like, okay, something bad happened to my brother. He got in an accident, so I'll be a helicopter parent. Or it's like, okay, something bad happened. I know bad things can happen, and I would like to live life. And I'd like the people around me to live life.
Yes.
And maybe similarly with cancer, you know, I have cancer. I need everybody to be concerned about me. I'm so scared. I'm so nervous. That's not mockery. If people feel like that's very legitimate.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, hey, I want to, I don't want to touch this part of the scared factor. You know, and I think that like past experiences and just personality types inform That's how exactly we react right. to that.
Yeah. There's a saying, which is things are not as they are as we are.
Right.
So mm-hmm. everything is through a lens of perception.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And it's one of those times when, you know, people listening to this podcast, it could be like, oh, wow, you know, I have cancer. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could be like that. But in some way, you can and can't. You know, you can mm-hmm. choose to be intake this information and be like, oh, well, this is a way to be. But really, I think those kind of gut reactions come from a long history of, you know, how we've dealt with trauma, how our parents dealt with stuff, how we, you know, and just
our culture, some of it's cultural.
Right, of course. To that, were you scared? Were there times when you were actually really scared?
Yes. And I just, before I answer that, I also want to just put it out there that, yeah, my experience is my experience.
Yeah.
I am not in any way advocating, recommending, oh, encouraging yeah. people to go work in bakeries while they're undergoing chemotherapy. Nor am I saying if people are pitying you, you should reject them and look
of
for
course.
A 25-year-old best friend. You know, but I do and the third point I want to make is just physically, like I've obviously have friends who've had friends who've had, I don't think I've had a super, super close, I hope I'm to say this and my friend will call me after this podcast and say, why didn't you mention it? But obviously there have been people with breast cancer in my life since I was diagnosed, but some of them have exactly kind of a similar scenario to me and a similar treatment, and it's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And they
right.
are in so much pain and they can't work. And they, so again, I mean, luck? I don't know. I guess I'm lucky in the sense that I think pain is funny, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure Bobby can speak to this. It's like how much of, I always say I have a really high threshold for it. Mm-hmm. Is that really because I feel things like pain is less in my body physically, or is it my personality? Is it just the way I handle life? So for me, mm-hmm. yes, it sucked. And was there one or two, I mean, I'm honestly, maybe only one or two days throughout chemo where I literally could not get out of bed, like
yeah.
one or two.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
People have weeks of that.
Right.
So I just want to say everybody's
yes,
different.
Totally.
I'm only speaking from my own experience and not in any way trying to say, yes. and you too can do breast cancer my way.
Oh, yeah. Of course. No, it's good that you said that. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we totally respect that.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I would like to address that pain thing. I have studied with and really value Jon Kabat-Zinn,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Full Catastrophe Living, which is an amazing book. It's huge, but I always tell people just read little parts of it. But there's a whole section on pain, emotional pain, physical pain, and I talk about this a lot because if you consider the aspect of physical pain, chronic pain, something you have to live with, if you have to live with something, whether it be for a week, a day, or forever, how are you going to, if you have a choice, if there's some choice on how you view it, the whole concept is that with mindfulness, instead of it being right in front of your face so that everything you view is through the pain, with mindfulness, you try to take it and put it off to the side. It doesn't mean it's not there. It's just with staying focused on something simple like your breath or the flour, butter, and sugar,
mm-hmm.
that way you can take the pain and it moves over to the side and you're not viewing everything through the pain. And that's how people can somehow learn to live with chronic pain or short-term pain. And I think you had so many things between your kids
yeah.
and the thing that you were loving, enjoying,
yeah.
the baking.
Yeah.
You know, it helped you maybe with the same amount of pain. And maybe
yeah.
it's not your physical body, but maybe it's a mentality or a way you viewed it.
It could be. And also yeah. the husband who one could call like deadbeat husband, like, hello, don't you want to go to chemo every day and call her
yeah.
doctors like three times a week?
Yeah.
But also, if that's what you're getting,
yeah.
like it, you're kind of, okay, yeah, this isn't, I mean, I'm doing okay.
Right.
This isn't that. And, you know, he's not like a nightmare, obviously. I'm
yeah.
still married to him. I didn't dump him. I think you're right. I mean, that's right in life. Like, it's all about how we think about things, how we view things,
totally.
How we package things in our head. But I love that image. I wish you guys who are listening could see what Bobby did, but it's like she's putting her hand in front of her. Oh, I shouldn't do that with the mic. She's putting her hand in front of her face to be the pain and then moving it over kind of to her ear.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's 100% true.
Yeah.
It's like how you view things.
That was a very good.
And there is support for that. And I really would suggest that book if anyone is suffering from either emotional, physical, chronic pain.
Can you remind us what it's called?
Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn.
Awesome.
And don't get scared by the size of the book.
Also, I was just going to put a plug in for Audible Books. I don't know if it's but my husband listens to everything in the car. We live in a neighborhood where we end up driving a lot because we don't have a subway stop. But anyway, Audible is great for especially for getting through something long.
Yeah.
But to answer your question about being scared, I don't want to say no because that's crazy.
You can say no.
But I don't remember. You know what? I joke that cancer is a job, a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And like anybody that's diagnosed and I hear about it and I'm talking to them, I say like, get ready. Because like the beginning, you go to a million doctors, you run around town with your like little like manila folder of your test. Actually, now probably everything's online. But back then, I ran around with pictures of my, you know, the x-rays and the this and the MRIs. And it was a full-time job. I remember like literally having my four-year-old in my car with me. Like, and back then, I really... All the listeners are going to be like, she was the oldest lady that they've ever had on their show. But literally, we didn't even have phone. I mean, I had a phone. Of course, I had a phone. But we didn't have, like, iPads. Like, Jack had, like, this little tiny, almost DVD player that he would bring to – anyway, I digress. But but I joke that it's a full-time job. For me, I think the beauty of it being a full-time job is that's – where I put all of my energy and thinking, getting it done. Like, oh, good. Today was a good day. I went to three doctors.
Right.
As opposed to, oh, my God, today was – I can't believe I had to go to
exactly.
– you know, it's just how I
–
again, just me. Nobody else has to do it this way or is expected to. But that's how I get through life-ish.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, these are the tasks. I'm really into lists. I don't know
totally.
About you guys. But you make
I love
your
a list.
Right? Mm-hmm. Lists for life, peeps.
Yeah.
But you make your list and you get through it. And
again, focus.
Yeah.
I think that probably was helpful in not going into this a really fearful place.
So your mind didn't wander too far.
100%.
Ahead of yourself.
Same
fear
with,
is negative anticipation of the future.
Same with the treatments. Like, there were 8 of them. They were over 16 weeks. Each, I mean, I just was like plodding through to get through those. Of course, I had moments, and it's possible I've blocked them out. Like, I'm really trying to like remember a time that I was crying a lot or very worried. But I think I didn't really allow my, and knock on wood, I still don't, like, allow my, I mean, this is, like, really, like, I hope I'm not jinxing myself, but I don't go to a place of, like, oh, my God, my cancer's, I don't even want to say it out loud, but you guys
I
know what I'm about
what
to say.
To say. Yep.
Yes. I don't even go there. It's just not how
That's
I roll.
Fear.
Yeah.
You don't go to a place of fear that often. So did you have certain foods that you like to eat when you weren't feeling well?
That's a good question. I tried to be, sadly, for me, because I love sugar so much, I tried to not eat sugar for the 16 weeks I was undergoing chemo. I tried to eat less red meat. I'm, it's just FYI, red meat and sugar are like my two favorite food groups.
Same.
I tried to eat less meat. I remember eating a lot of mushrooms, like sauteing tons of mushrooms because they're supposed to be, is it the iron? I'm not sure. There's something that's good in those.
Wonderful healing properties.
Yeah.
I don't know what they are, but.
That help with the chemo. My husband back then was a school teacher, and the school was incredible. And I can't even remember, could it have been every day? We got a lot, like they had that one of those food systemy things where people made food for us. Mm-hmm. I want to say for 4 months, but that sounds a little outrageous. But they gave us a lot of food.
Wow, that's so nice.
Yeah, and
that's
that
amazing.
Was everybody, you know, it's Brooklyn, so everything was like healthy and good for you. I was like, really? This is so healthy. But I ate it. And it was so nice,
that's
obviously.
Awesome.
But the things that stand out were the mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even think of other. It definitely wasn't a focus. I didn't. I wasn't horribly nauseous the way you can be on chemo, so I didn't feel like I can't eat anything or I can't eat all my favorite things. That was not my experience. But I do remember when I finished enjoying a whoopie pie at Baked, or if not several.
Yum, whoopie pie. So kind of wrapping it up here, we usually ask people the same question, and I think it's interesting to hear the different kinds of answers to this question, which is if you could give yourself a piece of advice when you were first embarking on this kind of journey with, you know, cancer, what would it be?
I mean, maybe part of me knew this then, but I probably couldn't have articulated that, like, kind of the cliche, like, you got this. Like, yes, it's going to suck. Yes, it's not ideal. But you're going to get through this. You're going to come out on the other side. Everything that is going to happen is 100% surmountable, and you will surmount it.
You will survive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Psyching yourself up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe on some level I knew that. I couldn't have articulated that to myself, I don't think, because mm-hmm. I was more in the moment of like, okay, I crossed that off the list, what's next? So mm-hmm. that kind of weird combo of in the moment, but also like looking at my next thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I look back on it, it seems like it wasn't that, things didn't take that long. Yeah. It was over pretty fast. I mean, 4 months of chemo sounds like a lot. I don't know. It is,
yeah.
But it wasn't.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think I would tell myself that.
Right. Well, Jesse, it was amazing to chat with you. You have such a wonderful energy and spirit.
Oh,
and,
yay.
You know, one of those folks. Well, actually, everybody that comes in here has this different kind of aura, and it's always positive,
yeah.
but it's always so different. And
yeah.
yours is this very sparkly, almost a Tinkerbell-like quality. Would you agree with that, Bobby?
I want to give you a hug with a fuzzy.
I know, you are wearing an amazing fuzzy.
Yes.
Fuzzy and adorable.
I just bought it, and I'm really excited.
It's really lovely. Can you tell us and our listeners where we could follow you, find
yes.
you, anything that you'd like to put out there or plug?
100%. So I'm on Instagram at Jesse Sheehan Bakes, and I am on Facebook at Jesse Sheehan Bakes, and then I have a website, Jesse Sheehan Bakes. And I wanted to mention that the article that we've been referring to is an article I wrote about my experience with breast cancer and working in a bakery, and I wrote it for Food 52. So you can Google me and Food 52, and that will come up.
Amazing. Cool. Oh, and can you just tell us the name of your book?
Oh, yes. And please check out my book, The Vintage Baker. And I also wrote a book called Icebox Cakes.
Yum. I love icebox. I love that like traditional icebox cake.
The vanilla and chocolate.
Yes.
100%.
It's one of my favorite things ever.
100%.
It's great. Actually, before we get out of here, I had a side thought because
yeah.
I love vintage clothing.
Yeah.
I love vintage interiors.
Yep.
And design and furniture and stuff like that. And I was like, why do I love this so much? Which I, you know, have pondered before.
Yeah.
But I was going to try to make a connection with you over
yeah.
this and ask you how you feel about it. I love vintage things because
yeah.
it reminds me of a time that I actually didn't even experience or know, but looking back in history, when things were well made, you know, with care and love, and they weren't just mass produced. They were unique. They were from the heart. They were from some, you know, without the influence
yeah.
of the internet or social media
yeah.
and like, oh, I want to just reproduce this thing or just make 1,000 of them. Is
yeah.
there any kind of tie to that with you about vintage baking?
Yeah. The only thing I would say tie-ish is that it was a time where like it wasn't about a drip cake or a geodome
right.
cake or the most beautiful sandwich cookie that you've ever seen that has the most amazing piped pastry. I mean, all of that is amazing and beautiful, and I am not in any way saying that I don't appreciate all of that, but the old desserts that I love were just simpler.
Yep.
There is not so much pomp and circumstance connected to them, and that resonates for me partly probably because I can't make a drip cake or
yeah.
pipe anything to save my life.
Same.
But also just that it was simpler then, and that's what I like now.
Yeah. Earnest.
Less pressure.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. It was really great to talk to you.
So great.
Thanks
to
so
you
much
guys.
For coming in.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee, representing 75% of U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry production. With over 100 articles published in health journals stating the vast health benefits of Michigan's superfruit, it's best to choose the cherry with more. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.